I actually think the first true album of the streaming era has been Kanye West's Life of Pablo. Endless delays, and up to the week it came out, it was like, is this thing really going to come out? And Kim Kardashian famously posted a Twitter poll being like, well, what do you think the record should be called? Like 2 days before it was supposed to be out. And like all signs were pointing to this thing is going to be a train wreck and it's not actually coming out. And then it did. And I was actually at the Madison Square Garden event where he premiered it. And it was really exhilarating because there was this sense, I think, that he wasn't going to pull it off. And then we all heard the record and was like, wow, he did.
93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steve and Hayden.
I've been thinking about you. Do you think about me still?
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. My guest today is Lindsay Zolatz. She's a writer for The Ringer. You may also know her from New York Magazine and Pitchfork. She's a really great music critic. And I invited her on the show today because I wanted to talk to her about the impending end of the MP3 era. It seems weird to say, you know, because iTunes, it's only been around for, you know, about 15 years or so, but we're increasingly reaching the point where streaming is going to be the only game in town, and downloads probably won't exist. And it's an interesting thing to ponder, and Lindsay's really smart, and she's written about this, and I think we had a really good conversation about it. So I'm excited to get to that, but before we do, I want to tell you about our sponsor for today's episode, and that is Amazon Music. And I'm a user of Amazon Music. I like it a lot. It's a really great service, and they're adding tons of great new songs all the time. Right now you can hear artists like Taylor Swift, Daft Punk, Kanye West, Bruno Mars, Blake Shelton, Katy Perry, The Rolling Stones, Springsteen, and the list goes on and on. At Amazon Prime, you can purchase songs individually or with your Amazon Prime membership. The collection is available for streaming at no cost to the listener. Songs will stream on most devices, including iPads, iPhones, Androids, Sonos players, and all the way down the list. And they can be downloaded for offline listening as well. And to act as sort of a primer for Amazon Music, there is a great new summertime listening playlist. And it's ideal if you're looking to discover new music, which is what we talk about here all the time on Celebration Rock. And this playlist, it includes great songs by artists like The Mountain Goats and Surfer Blood, and it's a really great variety. And the way that you find this playlist is you go to amazonsongofthesummer.com/celebration, and you can hear the whole list there. Again, that's amazonsongofthesummer.com/celebration. So you should definitely check out Amazon Music. So again, my guest today is Lindsay Zolatz. And, you know, it's weird to talk about MP3s in the way that people used to talk about vinyl. You know, people being nostalgic for the format of it. And of course, that sort of love of vinyl has sustained vinyl in this decade. There's been a comeback of that format. But when we look at MP3s, you know, this was the format that was supposed to put physical media out of commission, and yet it looks like more and more that digital downloads will soon be a thing of the past. So this was something I was very interested to talk with Lindsay about, and I thought we had a really great talk, and here it is. All right, well, thanks again for doing this. This is fun. So you're in Cincinnati?
I'm actually in Covington, Kentucky right now, which is across the river from Cincinnati, which I did not know until yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
How close Cincinnati was to Kentucky, but I'm here for a friend's wedding.
Okay.
And, yeah, just checking out the sights.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I didn't know if there was, like, urgent pop culture business in Cincinnati this weekend that you'd be covering.
Yeah, very much not. But it's some personal business, and I'm kind of, on a very selfish personal note, I'm relieved that the Frank Ocean record didn't come out, because it really would have ruined my weekend, because I would have had to write something about it immediately. So I'm glad, barring that it, like, dropped in the middle of this conversation, which I don't think it will.
Yeah, we should say, like, we are talking on Friday morning. It's about 10 a.m. Central, and everyone who is in the music media is on Frank Ocean album watch, and yeah. It hasn't come out yet, and you don't think it's going to come out at all?
I think it'll come out eventually, but I was skeptical even this week when he launched the live stream. I guess that was Monday morning when he launched this live stream of himself doing all this woodworking and with some ambient music playing in the background. You can look back on my work Slack channel that I said the record's not coming out this week and it's not coming out on Friday. I was a skeptic all along and I feel very validated today.
See, but like by the time this posts, the album could already be out and then we will both look foolish right
it's
now.
True.
So like who knows, but who knows? Maybe you know, it's so weird because like people can like look at this podcast as like a time capsule of what it was like before the album came out. Where we were is it gonna come out or not? I don't know. I mean, my thing with Frank Ocean is that in a way it would be better for him to just continually tease an album forever and never put it out, because the album that people are imagining will always be better than whatever it is that he actually puts out.
Yeah, which can probably only hurt him, sadly, in the reception of what actually comes out. But
only if he actually puts out a record. See, this would be my thing. I'd be like, this is like a shell game where you never put out a record. It just is always sort of an imaginary record that we can imagine being like a masterpiece, but it never actually comes out. I think that would be a great scam for him to pull off.
Yeah, and he is one of the few people that maybe could pull that off. But I do think, because there's a lot of internet chatter about people being really disappointed today because they thought, I guess there's a New York Times story that reported that someone from Apple had confirmed that it was coming out today. And I was skeptical even when that came out. But I think that a lot of people, the disappointment and the kind of thing that Frank has really let us down today, the same thing happened with Rihanna's album, Anti, less than a year ago. And that there was a day, there were innumerable teases for that record, and it was kind of, there were fake outs for the better part of a year that it was coming out, and there was a day that I think either she confirmed or someone from Tidal confirmed that it was going to come out, and then it just didn't, and you know, people were angry and disappointed, but then eventually the record came out, and I happen to think it was really good. I think it's probably her best record, and it spawned a bunch of hits. And so I think that whatever kind of disappointment, like I certainly don't think this is a strike against Frank Ocean just because it didn't come out today. I think people have a pretty short attention span in remembering this sort of disappointment, and it certainly didn't hurt Rihanna.
Yeah, I mean, the one difference between, or there's many differences, but one in this regard, the difference between Frank Ocean and Rihanna is that Rihanna has like more of a track history. Like she's put out a bunch of records and has a long career. Whereas Frank Ocean, you know, he has the Nostalgia Ultra mixtape and he has Channel Orange. And now there's been this long gap. And there is this sense of like, you know, people want to hear the record, but I think there's also a feeling like, is this guy really for real? Can he do it again? And like, I don't know what you've been hearing. I've heard rumors and, again, this podcast is a time capsule. It's possible that this record will come out immediately after we record this. But like I've heard rumors that maybe the album's not that good, and that's why it's been taking so long. That he's maybe adrift a bit, and I don't know. In a way, I feel like these delays sort of bolster that those rumors out there. You know that maybe he's just not. He's not putting anything out because there's nothing there, you know, either in terms of like the record not being good or maybe it's not even finished.
I do think I have heard those rumors. I also feel like I heard the same thing about the Rihanna record, but I do think the big difference between him and Rihanna is that before Rihanna's Anti came out, she was releasing a string of kind of one-off singles that felt very much like throwing certain things at a wall. Like, they did not really cohere in a way that said a new album is coming. So we got Bitch Better Have My Money, and then that awful ballad American Oxygen that was like her protest song about nothing. And those, there was a lot of time between when those came out, and you got a sense that she was kind of gauging the atmosphere and like seeing what people were responding to, but never solidifying that into a record. Whereas Frank Ocean, it's just been total radio silence for about 4 years now. And we haven't heard, you know, a single preceding this album. There hasn't been any sort of like demo necessarily that he's put out. So I think that's the biggest difference, is it's kind of like you said, it's just the tease and lead up has all been imagined really, and the songs, the future Frank Ocean songs in people's heads. And yeah, I think there's a lot of build up and possible disappointment of like, can whatever he does next live up to that possible expectation?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if there's a statute of limitations for audience goodwill or audience anticipation for this kind of thing. You know, because when I think about Frank Ocean, I think about Japandroids in a weird way, because you know their last record came out at around the same time, and they haven't put out anything, and it's been sort of radio silence from them too for a long time. And you know, similar to Channel Orange, when I think about Celebration Rock, that record, in a way, it's hard for me to imagine how they would even follow that up. Like, what would they do that they could build upon that? And I also think about that Avalanches record that came out recently, you know, like how the Avalanches for a long time, it was like, when's their new album going to come out? And there was a lot of anticipation for it. And the record came out and it was pretty well received. But in a way, I feel like that album, it's almost like they waited too long. I feel like like an Avalanches record in 2016, like what is that? You know, what kind of meaning does that really have? It just seemed like if this had come out maybe 5 or 6 years earlier, maybe it would have meant more, but it's almost like they waited too long and missed their window. Like, do you feel like there is something like that? I mean, you know, again, presumably if this Frank Ocean album doesn't come out today, you know, and again, it could be out, who knows, but, you know, just speaking theoretically, I mean, do you think that there is something like that for artists, you know, that you can miss your window in a way?
I do, and I think that this, the whole fake out of the live stream, of Frank Ocean launching this live stream when a lot of people thought it was going to be a full record, I think that was the first hint of, like, negativity and frustration I've really seen across the board, and, like, personally felt too. I wanted the record to come out that day. And I think he's such a kind of internet folk hero that I think part of what his appeal is has been like that in this age of information overload and people just putting out so much content and information and music and Instagrams and everything else, Frank Ocean has retained the sense of mystery and almost minimalism in his internet presence. Like, you don't feel overloaded by him. And I think in a lot of ways it almost feels like a statement of things that he's withholding. So I think that up until maybe last week, that was something that a lot of his fans, myself included, admired about him and thought was kind of cool and against the grain. But it's getting to a point now where, I mean, today Snapchat released like Snapchat Frank Ocean filters that are just, you can take a picture of yourself and it's like a skeleton that says waiting for the Frank Ocean album to come out. And the fact that that is such a universal sentiment that there is a Snapchat filter for it, you know, that doesn't make me feel great about the general consensus regarding Frank Ocean right now. But I think, yeah, I do think there's often a window with that stuff. And this week was the first time that I started to worry that he had missed it. But again, I've had so many like fruitless pop culture worries lately. I worried the same thing about Beyonce right before Lemonade, and I was very much proven wrong on that. So I really hope that he can prove me wrong and put out something that is actually worth the wait. But it's been a long wait.
Well, let's pivot to something that's a little broader from Frank Ocean, which is, you know, I wrote this piece this week looking at sort of the four-year gap between Frank Ocean Records, presuming that it's only a four-year gap anyway, and how when Channel Orange came out in 2012, in a way it was a watershed moment for iTunes because, you know, that record was an iTunes exclusive and for the first week, and it ended up, Channel Orange ended up like debuting at number two on the pop charts. It sold like 130,000 copies based solely on downloads. And here we are in 2016, and Boys Don't Cry, when it comes out, will be an Apple Music exclusive, which means that, you know, you can stream it only on Apple Music. Presumably it'll also be for sale at the iTunes store. But the focus now, as opposed to 2012, is on streaming and how we're even at a point now where, you know, streams, sales of digital downloads are down 42% from where they were at in 2012 at this time. And there's been rumors that iTunes is basically going to be shut down within the, in as soon as 2 years. Like, there was a story that was in May that there was a report online that Apple was considering discontinuing digital downloads. And Apple had to issue a statement denying it. But it seems like when you look at the trends where more people are streaming, less people are downloading, that seems to be where the winds are blowing. It seems like digital downloads at some point aren't going to exist. And, you know, I wanted to talk to you about this because you wrote a piece recently for The Ringer talking about the iPod Classic and how you still like listening to your iPod. And one of the things you talked about in that story was how the thing you like about the iPod versus streaming is that you have this sort of finite collection of music and how, in a way, it sort of reduces the number of choices that you have in your life. And that's refreshing in a way because, you know, we all live in this sort of crush of content that's coming at us constantly. And it's not just music, of course. It's, you know, it's social media, it's television, it's music, it's all, you know, it's movies, it's all that stuff. What do you think about this stuff that I was just talking about, I guess? I mean, do you foresee the end of digital downloads happening soon? And how do you feel about that? I mean, do you have any feelings about sort of streaming becoming the primary way that people are listening to music?
I do. And I think that I do think it's a very astute point that the gap between Channel Orange and Boys Don't Cry, the four-year gap there, there's been radical changes in how we consume music and also how sales and sort of success are measured. And I do think Frank Ocean is the type of artist that I don't know how he fares in the streaming environment, because if you look at, I think the artist who's probably benefited most in a lot of senses from streaming is Drake, and he's kind of emblematic of this streaming era. Views, his latest record has been on the top of the charts for like 12 weeks or something, that is largely, I think, derived from streaming. But that record felt tailor-made for the streaming experience because it's incredibly long. It's too long. I would say, I think, 20 tracks on Views. And he also kind of added older, previously released songs to the record that actually bump up the streaming numbers of it. So, like, he put Hotline Bling, a song from last year that got millions and millions of streams on the record, and is able to kind of lump that in with the overall success of the record. So, you know, you could argue that that song doesn't really have an aesthetic place on that record. It feels kind of tacked on at the end, but he reaps the benefits of that in a streaming economy. Whereas Frank Ocean, I think, is very much an album artist, and Channel Orange was really a full kind of expression, and there was an intro and an outro, and every interstitial and the flow between the songs felt very thought through, and it really was like a full, almost like old school kind of album experience. So I don't know. Streaming and being successful in a streaming era feels a lot more about the singles and the album, and more about picking and choosing what you want to listen to on the record. And I think Frank Ocean is old-fashioned in a lot of ways, and that's part of his appeal. But, yeah, I guess I worry a little bit about him making an album that is not as single oriented, and if that's going to translate, if people are really going to sit down and listen to the whole thing when it's not something that they've purchased. Yeah. So again, yeah, I'm very curious to see if and how he can adapt into that environment, and if maybe the anxiety over whether he can is part of what's delaying this record.
You know, you just made an interesting point, I think, about how formats influence the art in the way that that musicians sort of structure their music. You know, you talked about how, like, Drake has sort of, he kind of formatted views to kind of maximize the streaming format, you know, to kind of get as many streams as he could and to help kind of bolster his sales. You know, and, and I think you can see that throughout music history, certainly like in the 60s and 70s when vinyl was the format. You know, artists would structure their records in terms of album sides, you know, having a rise and fall on each album side. In the CD era, albums got really long. You know, like you would have 78-minute albums because CDs could fit like 79, 80 minutes worth of content. How do you see, I mean, do you see there being sort of, I guess, distinctive differences between maybe how albums, you know, were structured or came out when they were downloads versus streaming? I mean, is it just a matter of, you know, like in Drake's case, he put 20 songs on the record, you know, because he knew that, the more songs you have, you know, the more streams you're going to have, and that's going to help boost your sales. And like you said, he put Hotline Bling at the end of the record because that was a huge hit and it would help goose the album. I mean, do you see any other kind of distinctive things like that? That, I mean, are albums now all going to be like 30 songs long? Are we going to have like Guided by Voices records, except like, you know, they're going to be like 2 hours long? Is that going to be the new norm?
Yeah. I was going to say, I hope not, but I love Guided by Voices. So if everyone could make their Alien Lanes, like, I'll take, you know, 26 tracks or whatever. And if there is short, Guided by Voices songs. But
exactly.
I actually think the first true album of the streaming era has been Kanye West's Life of Pablo, which is an interesting thing to look at as kind of a counterpoint to views that he really, so similar kind of situation with Frank Ocean, where just endless delays and up to the week it came out, it was like, is this thing really going to come out? And he was, Kim Kardashian famously posted a Twitter poll being like, well, what do you think the record should be called? Like 2 days before it was supposed to be out. And like all signs were pointing to this thing is going to be a train wreck and it's not actually coming out. And then it did. And I was actually at the Madison Square Garden event where he premiered it. And it was really exhilarating because there was this sense, I think, that he wasn't going to pull it off. And then we all heard the record and was like, wow, he did. Not only does it exist, but it's really interesting. And then he, of course, famously now, you know, there are many famous Kanye tweets, but one of the more iconic of this year was when he said, I'm a fixed wolf, which just started this whole process of him tweaking the record after it already came out. And you could not do that in an age of downloads, to say nothing of CDs and vinyl and every other format. Like, that felt very unique to streaming. And whether you loved or hated that move by him, it was, I think, the first instance of an artist using that new format and the new platform of streaming to make aesthetic choices about his art and show that he, I think he described it at one point as like a living painting or something that right. Now, and which, you know, there's good and bad to this. I think he's mostly done tweaking it now, but obviously Kanye is a perfectionist, and the danger of that is he could never finish Pablo and like go on to the next record, which I really hope that he does. But I think that he found a way to turn what could have looked like a blunder in pushing this record back and not having it quote unquote finished when it was supposed to be into this exploration of what the new, of how streaming music can evolve and change and be really unique to the format in ways that even a digital download cannot.
Yeah, I wonder if, because I agree with you, I think that that is a pretty clear, you know, turning point in how albums exist in the streaming era versus any other era. Like, that is certainly something, like, as you say, that could not have existed in previous eras. I wonder if that is also the thing that will necessitate the album's end. You know, like, if we have now reached the sort of final evolutionary point. And, you know, look, people have been writing the album is dead think pieces for like 20 years, if not longer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's no, I don't want to throw dirt on the format again. I mean, it's shown to be incredibly resilient. I do think, though, that The Life of Pablo, it proves something that I've observed a lot when I've talked to artists, which is that albums only exist now because artists want to make them. You know, if artists didn't want to structure their music in that format, and they decided instead that, well, I'm just going to release songs on SoundCloud, you know, as I make them, I don't think that there would be a great outcry from the public. I mean, I think that there would be certain people that would miss it, and there would probably still be, you know, artists in certain genres that would continue to do it just because there's such a long tradition of doing it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's really no reason for The Life of Pablo to be an album, I don't think. It is sort of, it is this kind of different thing that is this sort of living, breathing, kind of constantly evolving thing. You know, sort of like, to me, like The Life of Pablo to me is more like a blog post that is calling itself a novel. You know what I mean? Like, a novel is something that, you know, is sort of set in stone, and at some point you put a frame around it and you send it off. Whereas something that exists online in a blog post form or a tweet or a Facebook post or whatever, you can edit it, you can change it, you can delete it, you can do whatever you want with it. And it's something different, but it's not a novel, you know, it's something different. So I feel like, but, you know, but for some reason, Kanye wanted to call it an album, probably because he's, you know, pushing 40 and like he is familiar with that format, and that's something that he's grown up with, and, you know, he's used to consuming music that way. And I just wonder, someone who's maybe 14 right now, like the future Kanye West, you know, are they going to feel that same kind of compulsion to call, you know, to structure their music in that kind of way? I don't know.
Yeah, I think the digitization of the mixtape is an interesting thing to think about in context with this too, because I think that now that especially a lot of rappers, but also artists of all different genres are starting to call their free releases and sometimes even commercial releases mixtape. There's a very that term feels very malleable right now, and I think that in the future, you know, if you look at Chance the Rapper, who put out his first two records for free as mixtapes and only really decided to charge for his new album Coloring Book, that I think he has referred to as a mixtape, because of the line in Life of Pablo where he says, like, you have to sell it to snatch the Grammy. So he's kind of, you know, he wants traditional success in that way and is kind of understanding, like, he wants a Grammy, which, like, Kanye, and knows that he has to sell the record and kind of think of it as an album as opposed to a mixtape for it to have a chance at this more conventional old school award. So I think that's a really interesting snapshot of like the tensions between those generations and the idea of the album, but the fact that there still is a desire to have this like cohesive statement that can then win the shiny trophy and be lauded as the album of the year by critics and whoever else. So, yeah, I think that a lot of future artists are going to be looking to that kind of mixtape output. And if you look at someone like Young Thug, or even to be very extreme about it, Lil B, just really prolific artists that will make a song one day, put it on the internet the next day, and kind of move on to the next thing. And their prolificness is almost the artistic statement rather than the album itself. So I do think we're at a crossroads with that. But yeah, I think people like Chance and Kanye, and even Drake to some extent, in the way that he kind of fetishized views as his big album as opposed to his mixtape that he put out, or put two mixtapes out between that. They were all for sale, but made this distinction. I do think there's still this desire to save it all for the big album and to make that as some sort of statement at the same time, while acknowledging that maybe that's out of date and maybe new things are coming down the pipeline.
I wanted to talk to you about your story that you wrote for The Ringer, where you talked about the iPod Classic and mm-hmm. still, you know, loving the iPod. And your iPod Classic, it still works, right? Like, you're still using it?
Oh, yeah. I have it on my desk right now.
Oh, right on. So, yeah. I mean, I'm wondering, you know, again, talking, you know, I was talking before about how digital downloads, you know, have, you know, sales are down dramatically over what the peak was. Again, the peak was in 2012, the year Channel Orange came out, and now, you know, we're almost half of what sales were at, you know, just 4 years ago, digital downloads. And again, there have been rumors that iTunes is considering, you know, discontinuing digital downloads. And basically, if iTunes no longer sells digital downloads, like, that will be the end of that format, you know, for all intents mm-hmm. and purposes. Do you think that there's any possibility that downloads could have a vinyl-like resurgence? You know, because, like, you see examples of this online where iPods go for hundreds, if not thousands of dollars on eBay. Like, there seems to be some sort of connection to these devices, whether it's sentimental or, again, if people have sort of an aesthetic love of the format versus streaming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think there's going to be a Jack White of digital downloads, or is this format doomed to extinction?
I said at the end of the piece that I do kind of foresee it becoming what vinyl was before vinyl became cool again. Maybe like vinyl in the 90s when people were still really into CDs, like it's sort of being this thing just for collectors and music snobs, and which is a term I use not derogatorily at all. Certain self-identification. But I argue that in the piece, and I actually was really blown away by the response to this iPod piece that I wrote. It's something I'd been kicking around in my head and just talking about with friends for quite a while. But when I finally put it out, I just like was not prepared for how many people really related to something in it. Because I do write in the piece too that when I use my iPod now in public, I feel a little bit embarrassed, and have had people kind of call me out on the subway and be like, you still use one of those things? So I felt pretty alone when I wrote this in my appreciation of this format. And then I wrote the piece, and so many people were like tweeting me pictures of their iPods and like what song they were playing on it. And it was the rare article where I did read the comments, because they were mostly pretty nice and thoughtful, and people, something about it like evoked this sense of nostalgia where people were writing about the day they first got theirs and who, you know, gave them certain music on it, and what relationships were chronicled in these playlists and stuff. And so it did, I think there's a very emotional, nostalgic response to this technology, which I sensed a little bit because I wrote the piece, but I was frankly surprised by how overwhelming it was and how many people reached out to me saying that they felt something similar. And again, how personal the stories were that people felt that they were prompted to share with me after writing this piece. So I do think there's going to be, I don't know if it will be analogous to the vinyl resurgence, but I think there's something just untapped in the streaming era of this kind of personal connection to the curation of the music and the distribution of it that there really just is a void for that right now. And I definitely saw that in the response to writing this piece. It was a lot.
Now, like, I mean, when people talk about vinyl, you know, if we're going to picture sort of the prototypical, like, vinyl fetishist, you know, they always talk about, you know, how it has better sound and sort of the mm-hmm. ritualistic quality of, you know, you get up every 20 minutes to turn the record over and sort of the quality of holding something in your hands and how that's great. And I'm saying this in a somewhat sarcastic voice, but, like, I also subscribe to a lot of those beliefs, too. So, like, I can make fun of it, but I can also support it. Okay, we have more of that conversation with Lindsay Zolatz coming up. Before we get to that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about our sponsor for this week's episode, and that is Harry's. And, of course, Harry's is a company known for high-quality razors, and they give you a good shave at a good price. And, you know, I've been using Harry's myself, and I don't want to get too graphic here, but I am a hairy dude, so I need a good razor. And usually when you get a razor, if you get a good razor, it costs an arm and a leg. And it just seems like a waste of money in a way. Or if you want to save money, you got to get a lousy razor and then your skin gets all cut up and nobody wants that. Harry's is the rare razor where you get both quality and you get a good price. And to introduce you to the Harry's experience, there's a starter set called the Truman. And for just $15, you get a razor handle, shaving cream, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Yes, German-engineered, so you know that we're talking serious business here. To get $5 off the Truman, all you need to do is go to harrys.com and enter the promo code ROCK, and you will get $5 off of your Truman set there. And again, all you need to do is go to harrys.com, enter the code ROCK at the checkout, and get $5 off, and you will help support the show. So please do that. All right, here we are back with Lindsay Zolatz. Like, for you with downloads, what do you see as the advantages to it versus just streaming something? Because they seem very similar listening experiences.
Yeah, well, I'll say first that another phenomenon I noticed in the response to the piece is that there's a nostalgia for almost in a way the low fidelity of the MP3 and the sort of glitches and imperfections in the files that people just became attuned to. I think, you know, just whatever music you're listening to at a certain formative age, whether, you know, regardless of the sound quality or the format or anything, you develop this kind of affection for the imperfections and the flaws in it. So there's a part in the piece where I talk about, you know, there's certain, not everything on my iPod was downloaded fully legally from the Apple Store, I must say. And there are files that I have that have, you know, drops or tags from, like, sketchy websites that I downloaded them from that are now, I've listened to those songs so many times that tag or that weird glitch or something is in my mind as a part of the content of the song. And that was a line that a lot of people reached out and were like, I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, there's almost a weird affection for, the bad compression of MP3s too, which is surprising to me. I'm probably totally making your skin crawl right now.
No, I'm not like a audiophile person in the least. I mean, my experience with downloading, it's a little bit different than yours. How old are you?
I'm 29.
You're 29, so I'm almost exactly 10 years older than you. So, like, for me, my nostalgia for bygone music consumption channels is like record stores and stuff, more than sort of downloading music. For me, like, downloading peaked, and I hate to say this, but it was during when it was illegal, like when Napster and Kazaa and all those places came out. And it quickly became this thing of being excited that I could hear all this music to sort of being an addictive thing where it was just consumption for consumption's sake. Like, I would just download music all night long because I could. And it was, I remember just having, like, record guides open and being like, well, I've never heard this record before, I'm going to get this. And then it became, I've never heard this artist before, I'm going to download everything they ever did. And it just became this thing where I had tons of files that I wasn't even listening to. But I got it because I could get it. And I feel like that's probably a fairly common thing for a lot of people, that sort of staying up all night and just downloading stuff. And to me, it really was an addiction. You know, it was sort of a compulsive thing. And, you know, in my piece that I wrote about downloads, I mean, I feel like in its initial incarnation, like digital downloads were like heroin, and now streaming is like methadone, where that sort of self-defeating urge to accumulate, you know, it's now sort of cleaner and it's easier.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of feeding this thing that I don't think is totally healthy in terms of being a music listener. Like, like this sort of, this emphasis on, you know, access and convenience and having anything you could ever want. You know, and again, like, I'm not a Luddite. I use streaming sites all the time. I like streaming sites. I like them for convenience sake, and, you know, I like having access to all this stuff. But I think there was something that was introduced in the download era, this sort of consumption thing, where we just plow through stuff, where we are just addicts for consumption now. And streaming sort of helps support that in a way that, you know, it's easier than downloading stuff, but I don't know, in a way it's supporting something that I don't think is totally healthy sometimes.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think my my experience in coming up in that era was different, because I was like 12 and 13 during the heyday of Napster, and it kind of coincided with me having my first personal computer in my room, like, and having this, you know, just all this music, like, first kind of getting into indie music and punk music, and feeling like there was this whole world of things to explore, and all those very sentimentalized like early teens experiences for me that did coincide with Napster. And I was downloading on my parents' 56K modem, so I was not getting a whole lot of bang for my buck there. I think that I really could only download one song at a time, and it might take, you know, 20 or 30 minutes, and my sister might be mad at me, so she might pick up the phone in the kitchen and disconnect my internet connection. So there are all sorts of, I think I didn't have that sense of abundance in the beginning. It was very much like, you know, selecting a certain song, praying that the download would finish, or that it would not be some mislabeled MP3 as like a crappy band trying to pretend they were Radiohead or something like that. So there were all these experiences that I think just, again, any experiences with music you're having in your early teens and at that really formative age, I think you're going to develop a certain nostalgia and affection for whatever that is. So for me, it was this Napster era. And of course, there was, you know, kind of the added romanticism of it being illegal, and of, you know, seeing on the news people like Lars Ulrich trying to shut it down and being really self-righteous. It was a good time to feel like that was sort of this act of rebellion. But yeah, I do have a lot of nostalgia for those kind of early explorations but I think it's also been a kind of unfashionable and maybe even nerdy thing to express nostalgia for, because again, like, coming up in that era and with all the sort of rockism implied in the vinyl era and everything, it's, I think we were made to feel like that was an inferior way of listening to music from the outset.
Oh, yeah. And well, same thing with CDs, too, I feel like. You know, even CDs now. And, you know, I'm the Jack White of CDs. I'm gonna be the CD fetishist, because it is pure, it probably has a lot to do with just that being the first format that I had. You know, that's my first buying music experiences was getting CDs. Yeah. So I have that attachment. Yeah, when you were talking there, it just made me remember, you know, like those times, like, where I'd be up so late downloading music and I finally had to go to bed, and I'd have like 100 downloads, or, you know, not 100, but like a bunch of downloads going. and just hoping like, okay, I'm going to go to bed. I'm going to leave my computer on, because it would take like a long time sometimes for music to download. And then like you'd wake up in the morning and they would like be screwed up. Like they wouldn't have finished it. And it'd be like, oh, why didn't it just be crushing? The crux of your piece talking about the iPod Classic is talking about this idea that I think a lot of people can relate to, which is sort of setting self-imposed limits on the amount of, you know, content that comes into your world. You know, that the nice thing about an iPod is that it's your library, you know what it is, you don't have to worry about keeping up with all this other stuff, and how that's kind of refreshing in today's world, which I think is a great point. I think a lot of people sort of instinctively relate to that. In my piece, though, I kind of went in the opposite direction, where one of the concerns I have about streaming, and if streaming does become the primary way that people listen to music, is the way that it seems like it's a limitless choice when you go on these streaming sites, but in reality, there are choices that have been taken out of your hands in a way. And to me, this is all tied up in sort of the death of ownership, like how music fans now, you know, if streaming is the way that we're going to go, that people aren't going to own their own music, that they're all going to be relying on this central well, which means that we're sort of relying on Spotify, Apple Music, and as well as the record labels to be sort of the preservationists of music. You know, that like if you want to hear something, you have to go to a streaming site. And, you know, there's an assumption that anything you want is going to be there, but one, that's not true. There's a lot of music that's not on streaming sites. The other thing, too, is that just because a record is there today doesn't mean it will be there tomorrow, that an artist or a label could decide to pull your favorite record off of a streaming site, and they could put it on some other streaming site, or they could just hold it for ransom as they're trying to negotiate maybe a better royalty rate or whatever the case may be. But to me, that is a big sea change that maybe people aren't talking about as much. This idea that, you know, that's existed for decades now, that you would have your own music collection, that you would buy music, and it would be there whenever you wanted it. How that idea has sort of been put out to sea, you know, and you have streaming sites sort of openly encouraging people to like give, you know, to sell off their CDs and to get rid of their downloads and all that. Yeah, so we're not going to own music anymore. We're just going to rely on this, on these streaming sites. What is your take on that? I mean, do you feel like that matters, or am I just being an alarmist with that?
No, I do feel like it matters, and I think it's the part of the streaming era that I hate the most and that I wish we were talking about more, because I think I kind of sense a lot of discontent bubbling up with this idea. And I think what bothers me more is just the fact that, you know, like you said, there's these competing exclusives. So if the Frank Ocean album comes out this week or whatever, it's going to be an Apple exclusive probably for about 2 weeks. So people who only have Spotify or only have Tidal cannot listen to it for the first 2 weeks. You have to pay $10 a month or whatever it is to Apple to hear this record. And same with when Life of Pablo or Lemonade was only on Tidal. And I think the frustration that I'm feeling, and that I think a lot of other listeners are feeling, is that we're, you know, when you used to be paying that money to an artist, there was something about feeling like you're supporting them, even if it's that feeling was just an illusion. But I think now we're being asked to pledge allegiance to these corporations, and we're never going to have the same kind of feelings about a streaming service as we are about our favorite artists. It's just not how it works. And I do think we're reaching a point in the whole streaming arms race between these mainly three big competitors, but there's other ones out there too, where the listener is really getting screwed over in their competitive war to get the hottest exclusive titles. And I really, I think that's the part of this whole era in music that bothers me the most. And it's because it does feel, I think that there's the illusion of the artist trying to say like, oh, you're going to support the artists and get the most out of, you know, with the whole the terrible optics of the launch of Tidal, which with that disastrous press conference and everything that in the end just looked like a lot of really successful artists saying, give us more money and support us.
Right. Noel Gallagher said that they looked like the Avengers, which I thought, you know, I'm just going to quote Noel Gallagher for every episode, I think, of this podcast because he's a genius.
Yeah, always go to Noel for the quote. But he's right. And I think that stuff really matters in the sense that, yeah, you're still asking listeners to fork over however much money a month. And if you don't feel good about the place the money's going to, and you don't feel like you actually are contributing to the production of this art, I think there's an icky feeling you get. Like, I actually, I'm probably a bad representation of the average music listener because I kind of do it for a living. I'm subscribed to all three services right now, Tidal, Spotify, and Apple Music, because I have to be, because I have to hear what comes out for my job. But it's frustrating to me that, you know, the average listener, if they're really into music, that they would have to do that too. And a lot of people can't afford to be subscribed to all three. So it does feel like the listener is getting lost and kind of screwed over in this war between three pretty powerful corporations. And that is the part of this that just sits uneasily with me.
Well, and for me too, you know, like when I wrote my piece, I had people, some people agreed with it. There were a lot of people who said, well, you know, I don't really care what the format is. It's just about the music. And I understand that. And, you know, and I, of course, I mean, I think the music is the most important part. But what I think people need, I think what's important to note here is that distribution channels do influence how people look at music. Just like the formats affect the art. The distribution channel sort of affects the audience's mindset. And I think that the best example of how streaming and sort of this myth that Spotify has everything, I think, you know, the best example of that is when Prince died in April. You know, there were a bunch of media outlets that did stories about where to find Prince's music. You know, like, how can you listen to Prince's music? And the reason why was because people went to Spotify and they couldn't find any of Prince's records, because at that point he was only putting them up online on Tidal. So it was as if people didn't understand that you could still go to iTunes, you could still go to Amazon, you know, you could order his CDs, you could download his music. It was very easy to find. But because it wasn't on Spotify, it was as if the music didn't exist, or it was invisible, or it was inaccessible. Mm-hmm. And I do think, you know, I do think that the average music listener, they're not going to subscribe to three services. They're going to subscribe to one. And if they don't find what they're looking for on that one, then they're going to stop looking. And that's where it ends. And to me, that is the thing I really don't like about the streaming era, because streaming has a way of sort of creating an invisible border around music. And because people believe that everything that exists is on Spotify, which isn't true, but like they believe that, that if it's not on there, then it's as if it doesn't exist and it becomes invisible. And I just think that that's alarming to me, you know, because there's a lot, because to me, like, there ought to be avenues for music that isn't up online. I mean, and there's, you know, like, I think about, you know, if we're going to talk about, you know, there's obviously big artists who have sort of had their music online and pulled it, you know, Taylor Swift, Adele, Coldplay, you know, Neil Young, artists like that. Then there's labels like Drag City, you know, the famous indie label from Chicago, where, you know, Joanna Newsom and Bill Callahan and artists like that are on that label. None of their music is on streaming services. Are people still going to be able to find that stuff if streaming becomes sort of the only way that they listen to music? Or is that stuff going to become even more marginalized? You know, to me, these are the questions that are sort of arising as streaming takes over.
Yeah, and I think that's the frustration that goes all the way back to when Radiohead put out In Rainbows with the Pay What You Want format, that it started this discussion of like, well, yeah, they can do that because they're Radiohead and people are going to give them money no matter what. But it only, I think certain moves like that, like you're saying, only really benefits like the 1% of really popular artists. Whereas, you know, the Adele album obviously set huge records, even though it wasn't on any streaming services. Arguably, because it wasn't on any streaming services, people were compelled to buy it. And it works for her because she's Adele. But yeah, I agree. Like that same format maybe doesn't work for Joanna Newsom or someone who is not going to sell Adele kind of numbers and for whom streaming might actually benefit and like expose other people to their music. So I think that's something that frustrates me too, is that it really just helps the artists who are already really successful. Even though a lot of streaming services sort of talk a big talk about buzzwords like discovery and things like that, in the end, this is only exacerbating the idea that the biggest artists only get bigger.
Right. So I think what we're saying here is that people should hoard downloads like old people stuffing money into bed mattresses.
Absolutely.
And hoard CDs and basically, you know, avoid all technology because it's evil. And no, that's not what we're saying. But, you know, again, I think these things are worth considering. Because to me, again, I like streaming services. I use them. To me, the sort of ideal would be that you could stream if you wanted to, but these other things would also still be in existence. That you would have the option, because to me, like, I want to be able to stream, but I also want to be able to buy certain things if I want to keep it for my own library. And I just wonder if that's going to continue to be an option. Like, if I were to guess, like in 2020, my guess is that downloads will not exist, and there will still be vinyl for people that have audiences that want to buy vinyl. There may be some CDs. My guess is that CDs will probably still exist, but just like catalog CDs. So if you want to buy a James Gang album for $4.99 from Amazon, you can do that, but you probably won't be able to buy maybe the latest Adele record or Taylor Swift record on CD. Otherwise, I think it is probably going to be all streaming in 2020. You know, that's my crystal ball. It's an imaginary crystal ball, but that's where I see us heading.
Yeah, I think the other takeaway is if you still have an iPod Classic, hold on to it, keep it in its original box, and it will be worth $1 billion.
So. It'll be like dinosaur bones or something. It'll be in museums.
Oh my God, yeah.
And we'll be looking at it. Well, Lindsay, you know, I've kept you here for a long time, so I should let you go. But thank you so much for talking with me. This was really great.
Yeah, this was really fun. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. All right, that was Lindsay Zolatz of The Ringer. Really fun conversation with her, really interesting. And I want to thank you guys all for listening to this week's episode. And again, you know, please visit our sponsors, Amazon Music and Harry's. If you don't support them, we do not have a show. So thank you so much for patronizing those fine people. And it also helps to support the show if you help us spread the word a bit. So if you could leave us a review on iTunes, or you could just talk about us on social media, or tell a friend about us. All these things help to spread the word and to build our audience. So thank you so much for doing that. Otherwise, guys, it's been another great episode, and I appreciate you so much for listening, and we'll see you again next week.